The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2017 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2017. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
At time, so I'll maybe go ahead and start, if that's okay. Welcome, everyone. I'm Joshua Drake. I teach at Grove City College. I teach a lot of things there, art and music, church music, music literature, music appreciation, things like that. So that's sort of what I want to talk to you about here today. The title of my talk is a little provocative, as probably you noticed, so hopefully it's not too provocative. Chests Without Men, Teaching Music, Not Blind Enthusiasm. Many of us have patiently endured the Mr. Collins of the classroom. Does everybody know what I'm talking about? His unbridled enthusiasm about a subject on which he is ignorant floods group discussion. And this wash sometimes threatens to drown out those whose mastery of the subject actually gives them license for what moderate enthusiasm they can display. Now, it doesn't take many years of teaching to discover the difference between the fawning and the sincere student. And the difference between the two is a matter of affections, to be sure, but I don't think it's quite in the way we'll be talking about at this conference. For the fawning student has his scenes of affection, right? He can fall into hysterical exuberance at the drop of a word, right? The very sound of those three long syllables, Beowulf, right? Conjure up from him unending superlatives. Now, only you, who have the greatest papers, know how little justified are his reactions. Not, of course, that Beowulf is unworthy, but that the young man hasn't yet discovered its worthiness. His affections are therefore groundless. We know that this behavior sometimes extends into adulthood. Words like classical or Christian worldview or any Latin motto made of words with good English cognates can sometimes solicit the same kinds of enthusiasm from those who've never made it through the annals, can barely translate Caesar, and have reduced their own library of Penguin classics to a stack of Christian or a stack of other worldviews. Of course, Mr. Collins, and I need to stress this, Mr. Collins is not the villain of the novel, right? He's not. And actually, in some ways, he's kind of helpful. Those who suffer from his tendencies need only master the material that they have prematurely gushed over, and all will be very well, right? It's not that bad. Their false enthusiasm itself may spur them into valuable books they hope to and feign to love. And we've all seen how this correction process works, perhaps in our own lives. I've certainly seen it correct itself insofar as it has corrected itself in my own life. So I understand this from the inside. But such a correction is long overdue on the subject of music, and that's what I'm here to talk to you about. I feel almost certain that all of you would tell me that you like music. Let me put a point on it by means of experiment. I suspect that almost all of you could tell me whether Jane or Elizabeth Bennet were the more trusting character. That most of you know who Hrothgar is, right? Most of you could tell me who gives the famous to be or not to be speech. But how many of you, and I have no doubt that some of you could hum the aria from Bach's famous Goldberg Variations, or the opening theme of the first movement of Beethoven's Sixth Symphony, or Siegfried's horn call from Wagner's Ring, right? Some of you could. But I dare say that not nearly as many of you could do that as could answer the first set of questions. And this is not. This is meant only to point out a disparity of knowledge, a very much licit one. There's nothing wrong with not knowing everything. None of us know it all. But this disparity between the knowledge of literature and knowledge of music is much greater than even we might really suspect. Now, there was a time, of course, when we could not count on our first-year teachers knowing Hrothgar, right? Over time, we've raised up a generation of young teachers who've learned and then taught a body of literature that was nearly lost. Now, many people have discovered that there's a body of musical literature that is in even greater peril. Symphony orchestras all over the country are shutting down. Undergraduate music departments cannot meet their enrollment numbers. Meanwhile, the whole world believes itself madly in love with music, by which they mean that it is something that they treat like an aromatherapy candle, to be wafted irregularly while doing other things. Now, no one laments this situation more than I do, and it's tempting, as a first step, to start playing cheerleader, to speak with wild enthusiasm about music to anyone who will listen to me, and hope that that enthusiasm will be catching. My experience in the classroom tells me, however, that impressionable young students who aim to please will quickly take up my enthusiasm and language long before they ever learn a single melody about which to be enthusiastic. And then in the end, they may drop the enthusiasm altogether. They are, to invert Lewis's famous title, chests without men. Now, if this were a matter like the one we face in literature, where young college graduates, eager to teach in classical Christian schools, arrive with more enthusiasm than knowledge of a body of literature, well, the problem would probably solve itself in time, and here's why. Anyone who wants to teach in one of our schools probably understands at least what it's like to read a book with sensitivity, right? We wouldn't have hired them otherwise. Having that kind of sensitivity, he need nothing more than a good library and time to solve his problems, right? So that seems very good. But when it comes to music, the situation's different. When it comes to music, many people are misled into a false enthusiasm because they have really never listened to it at all, however so much it may be a part of their lives. The problem is peculiar to music, I believe. It's a hard thing to demonstrate, but I think it actually is peculiar to music. One cannot really read the words of a book in sequence without attending to at least some of the meaning of some of them. We know what it's like when our students don't quite get to the bottom of the text. We understand that problem full well, but they certainly have gotten to something while they're reading. It's at least apparent that they really read the book. But one can very easily play a recording of music and have it become a backdrop to whatever thoughts happen to cross his own brain. Most forms of popular music today actually encourage that sort of listening. Their musical material comes in sequence, but it has little or no development or interaction with itself. People whose listening behavior is formed by music of this sort may think that teaching young people to enjoy music is really just cheerleading, right? That is, you fill a classroom with some nice sounds, perhaps in the background while students work, say nice things about classical music and the glory of God. It perhaps never occurs to them that the labor that these great composers put into their works would surely have been ill-spent if the results were only white noise, right? It's impossible. It has perhaps also not occurred to them that the beauties of music, like the beauties of literature, are explicable, demonstrable, and communicable. We can share them with each other and talk about them clearly. We can teach music in very similar ways as we teach poetry. Now, in my 12 years of undergraduate teaching, I've seen countless instances of students raised in homes where classical music sat in the background like the Kincaid painting hanging over the mantle. Such students are surprised to struggle through my classes, and at the end, they all say the same thing. I have had music in my life since I was a child, but I had never really realized what it was like to listen to it. Now, I don't think that's any special commendation on my teaching. If I thought it were at all, I wouldn't have said it. I think it's a bit of evidence. It's a bit of evidence it seems to prove that many people who listen to classical music go to concerts and support their local symphonies, nevertheless do not listen to music. They listen to it like a handful of sounds that appear in the breaks between periods of thought that occupy their minds while the music is playing, right? And surely many of us, I know what that listening process is like, and it's very incomplete. It's analogous to reading a book while falling asleep and suddenly discovering that you've been flipping pages for half an hour without nothing more than the vaguest idea of what had been going on, right? And certainly, if we all remember our undergraduate careers of 500 pages a week, you know, yes, right, fine, wake up again. You know, it's so to solve the problem, and here's where it becomes difficult, to solve this problem, we need more than mere time and a good library of recordings. We need teachers to discover for themselves the pleasures of active listening, And this is a topic that my colleague Paul Munson is going to be talking about in a later session on what it's like to deal with musical meaning. I'd urge you to come to his talk if you want to kind of dovetail this idea with another one. But since I've been given such a generous allotment of time, I want to give you a sense of what active listening is like, while at the same time showing you how I might teach a piece of music so that students are, at the very least, given something to be enthusiastic about. If, in the end, they cannot abide serious music, at least they will know what it is that they dislike, and they will not deceive themselves by treating serious music as if it were a room decoration, right? Now, let me make it clear at the onset that I've been the beneficial recipient of many types of musical teaching, and because of this, I know that my way is only one of many. It's the way it takes, and actually I prefer it. But whatever form music teaching takes, it's bound to relate to the basic parts of musical listening. And those are pretty easy to understand. Those parts are memory, comparison, and reflection. Were we to listen to a piece of Javanese music or a folk song from Paraguay, these three things would still serve us equally well, just as well as it will with a piece of Schubert I'm going to talk to you about today. Anyone wishing to enjoy, let alone learn, a piece of music must first remember the musical ideas as they are presented, compare them to ones that follow, and then reflect on how those things relate. So I want to do that now with you with a piece of music, a short piano piece by Franz Schubert. Now, it's customary to begin discussions of music by placing works within the context of composers' biographies. Now, there's a lot of fun to be had in doing that. I have to admit it. It's an indulgent pleasure in some ways. But I think the practice can be deceptive, and here's why. Uncomfortable as most of us are with abstract meaning of any sort, people tend to want to make connections prematurely between musical meaning and biographical meaning, between the meaning of a piece with the biography of the composer's life. It's as if someone said that the theory of special relativity, which was published in 1905, is somehow illuminated by the fact that Einstein's son, Hans Albert, was born the year leading up to it, right? And we feel like we understand relativity so much better for that fact. It's not like that, right? It's not like that because post hoc ergo propter hoc. It's a fallacy, right? We don't understand that one. In fact, music rarely relates at all to composer's biography, because it speaks with a kind of abstract meaning that can only distantly connect to non-musical meaning by means of analogy. If we run too quickly to the analogy, we'll miss that golden non-verbal, that golden abstract meaning that music has to offer us. So today, I'm going to tell you a few things about the piece anyway, because I said it was an indulgent pleasure. I'm going to indulge. This piece I'm about to play for you, let me tell you a few things about it. Franz Schubert was the torchbearer at Beethoven's funeral on March 26, 1827. The piece was written 1 month later and inscribed In Memoriam, April 26, 1827. Schubert died in November of 1828, and the piece that I'm about to play to you was suppressed. Probably because of its compositional novelty, I have to tell you that it's so easy that even I can play it. It did not appear for publication until, get this, 1870, some 43 years later, right? Brahms' mid-career. The score is marked only allegretto, but I think most people tend to think of it as an impromptu, if that's a term that's familiar with you. The first compiler of Schubert's works, Otto Deutsch, numbered this piece 915, and thus you'll find it published with the initial letter D for Deutsch and the number 915. So Schubert fans tend to talk about D numbers, D915. And that's the easiest way to find it in a Google search, D915 and Schubert, and you've got it. I'm now going to play this piece for you, not on a piano, but I've got a recording, because I know that we all struggle with musical attention. We all do, okay? Those of us who have PhDs in it, the rankest amateur. I'm going to ask you to go ahead and circle your place within the form as we go, insofar as you can. I've given you a little rough and ready sort of letter outline in the handout. If you don't have it, it's not that big a deal, but and it certainly isn't necessary. But I think it helps aid in the mnemonic and comparative faculties of musical listening. This piece has three major sections, and I'm going to call them A, B, and A. Doing so suggests that the last third of the piece is identical to the first third. Just as a way of keeping up with Schubert's paragraph breaks, I'd encourage you to go ahead and track the piece in terms of those three big groups. You don't have to worry about the lowercase letters if you don't want to. A, B, A. This is not, I must urge, a way to understand Schubert's meaning any more or less than noticing paragraph breaks is a way to understand an author's meaning. But without paragraph breaks, I dare say we'd all make a lot less sense of authors, so I think it's maybe helpful. Okay, so now I'm going to play this piece for you. Here's hoping. Thank you. great, isn't it? Yeah. And I know some of you will ask, it's Sviatoslav Richter playing with the Deutsche Grammophon. So Richter's my favorite pianist. Okay, so you may have noticed that it is the first and the last thirds that contain the most important material. So I want to focus our attention on the A sections, right? The piece opens with two different versions, very different versions, of the very same thing, right? The first phrase is minor. It ascends quickly, and after a big leap down, wiggles its way back to where it started. No low C this morning. And then we have the second phrase, which is major, after the same quick ascent. It wiggles down again. It ascends to a climax and a conclusion, right? So I don't think it takes a lot of musical imagination to see those two phrases as in opposition to one another. But because I didn't sing them very well, I want to play them again for you. Let's just listen to those two. Looks like it's going to wind its way back down. And then up. D. Right? So important is this, of course, it's going to do it again, right? We alternate between those first and second phrases twice over so we can easily grasp this polarity. Again, major. So the two, and then we fall as a kind of response to this polarity. We have one phrase that's kind of a downer. The other one seems more optimistic, right? As a response to that, a little bit of complicated counterpoint with two versions of the second half of the phrase put against one another, out of phase. And that leads to ultimately a very low descent and some jagged chords. So listen to how that happens. Same phrase against each other. What happens next? There's a little pause, there's a little caesura, right? And what are we to make of this? It's a musical depiction of working out of problems that doesn't seem to go very well, right? Phrase one, phrase two, phrase one, phrase two, some significant counterpoint, some kind of significant descent, and then some garbled chords, finally leading to a dominant. What are we going to make out of this? What are we going to make of this? It bottoms out, it's cut off sharply by sharp strokes. What follows these strokes is unmeasured silence. Now, it's tempting at this point to entice your students with all sorts of metaphorical applications. Good, evil, minor, major. I don't think that's a really wise idea at this point, right? I think I'd best leave well enough alone. I'd urge you to do the same if you teach a piece like this. Music succeeds by being able to apply its meaning in many different contexts because it is abstract. If I prioritize one of these over all the others, I might deceive you into thinking it to be the meaning of the music itself. A lot of people think that meaning of music is whatever first application somebody puts on it, right? It's a very unwise approach because it's not what music's for. If it were for that, it would be poetry, and we just write poetry, which is a very fine thing in its own right. All right, so let's move on. We've had our silence. What happens next? A third version, the same tune. All right, this third version ends high, like the second version. It ends optimistically. Like the second version, it's also major. But unlike it, it is in C major. The piece itself begins in C minor, which means that the third version is not, as the second version is, an alternative to the first, but is in fact a transformation of the first, right? And that's critical to his purposes here. If we were to stop right there, our ending would be a happy one, and this piece would be very un-Schubertian in some ways, right? But the A section does not stop right there. And I think you all remember what happens next. This happens next. Reach higher. The C major ascent is a happy ending, but happily we do not end with it. I think that would, and instead we go to a much longer phrase than any of the ones hitherto we've met. Climbs higher and higher, only to fall off to the lowest note of the piece, and allows us to end in C minor, in the A section, C minor, not C major, and close out the big first big section of the piece. Now, at this point, Schubert asks us to repeat a portion of that first section, I think because he wants to hear us work through the development and conclusion again. So that's what we do, and it sounds like this. So now you remember where we are. This is the phrase against itself bent, and you must yield not, right? Glances, happy ending. Just what we hope for. A C major version of the first phrase. Isn't that nice? Yes, it's nice. In a sense, repeats like that in Schubert, or something like a do-over. He tricks us into not necessarily knowing that they're going to be the same thing again. I mean, he could have ended in a different way, right? If he's could, I mean, granted, I've already given you a little outline, so we all know what really is going to happen, and we've listened to it once, but coming to it as a naive, you don't know what's going to happen next. And so as we go through all that music again, if we were really being naive about it, we think, well, maybe it could end in a different way. Then maybe we could end in the C major, because it doesn't end in C major. Instead, we do something else, right? We add the repeat, and it's a bald repeat. It's a true repeat. When it doesn't change, we are crushed. So we move on to a second section of music altogether. And that second section of music is a diversion. The performer is asked to put the damper pedal down to play two strings, not three. Everything goes quiet and changes to a fairly unstable A-flat major, a distant key. It's not a key that's is not important in the first section at all. So it is a digression. The second major section, the B section, has two parts, and each of those are presented twice. The first of these is almost banal. It's a lovely thumb twiddling. And we're going to repeat it. We're going to do that again, right? As if it really deserved that. Byron says, we madly smile when we should groan, delirium's life's best deceiver. Right? And then our second half of the B section. The second section is a little more interesting. It goes to this remote key of G flat. But again, just up and down to no effect. Thank you. I think most listeners are going to hear that B section is a kind of diversion and not a solution. I could actually spend a little time to show you how it's not arbitrary, that the ya-dum, ya-dum is actually generated out of the dum-bum of the final stop of the phrase, but I don't think we need to. Because whatever Schubert's developmental purpose is there, he's certainly distracting us from the big problem of the A section. That's his intention. And I think most people are going to hear that. I think a lot of us would be, in a strange way, glad to get back to the A section, which is exactly where we go. Kind of hope that it might be transformed. But of course it isn't. Instead, it repeats exactly as it first appears. We discover all the same problems and all the same failed solutions. Now, the question of whether you really want me to play that for you or not. It's only about a minute and a half, so I think I'll do it. Here's the repeat of the A section. He actually wrote it all out, right? So he did not say, go back to the beginning as composer, but he actually writes it out, play it all again, right? Which I think is in itself telling. So here it is again. There's our same second phrase, right? The piece ends tragically. I think that's pretty clear. Now, adjusting for the audience, I think this is a way that any of you could teach any piece of easy to understand music. I really do. I can think of dozens, maybe even hundreds of pieces that I could have chosen instead of this one. That's a repertoire issue. I mean, it takes a long time to get to know a big repertoire. There's a lot of music. I know conference speakers say this kind of thing all the time, but really if you're struggling with that and you want to think, what kind of pieces kind of work for this level, just send me an email and I'll maybe take a couple of days, but I'll come up with something. May not be the right piece. I'll send you an email back. I really do think that hundreds of pieces could have been taught in the same sort of format. You'll notice I made very little reliance on technical terms, and the ones I used were not strictly necessary, right? That major and minor even is not even essential for the discussion I just had. That's something that could be obliterated from it. The argument would hold fast. You could substitute any number of terms. People would still hear it. So it isn't an issue of technical knowledge. Nevertheless, I suspect that saying something like that, a lot of you are going to worry. I'm kind of ill-equipped to do this. A lot of people feel that. I think for good reason. We live in an age that doesn't help us in this regard at all, right? So, we have to make do with what we have, right? And I think that some people are worried that they might themselves not be able to notice that kind of musical meaning if they were set loose to listen to pieces on their own. This is all very well and good, sitting in a lecture, hearing somebody talk about it, but it might be hard for me to do. Some of you, you have a lot of musical background. Maybe it's not that hard. But I suggest that your anxiety is probably mislaid, largely because of the process of listening. That if you'll take a pen and paper out, right, and take notes while you listen, just as you mark up the margin of a book you're about to teach, right? Don't bother with the score. If you can read music, that's great. I think that's wonderful. That can be very helpful. But if you can't read music and you still want to do this sort of thing, you can do it. Just take a piece of paper in the alphabet, right? And notice what's happening in sequence. Is this the same thing I just heard, or is this new? Let's give it a letter if it's new, a new letter. Are these things related rhetorically? Is this presenting a kind of question? Is this an answer? Is this a problem? Is this a solution? Is this a bad guy? Is this a good guy? And I think if you write notes for yourself like that, I think most people can do a really good job of this. I really do. And I think, of course, the result of that is active listening for yourself, too. I mean, I the pieces I teach, I learn to love a lot better than the ones I just meet at the concert hall. Having a conversation with your headmaster, classical music radio is going on in the background. It's going to be this distracting affair where, like, you're tuning into the music and they're talking and, oh, great. So be aware of that danger. Obviously, the more active listening, the more hard it is to listen passively. But that's maybe no bad thing, right? Now, the next big question is, can this be tested? Can we know that they know this music? And I think a lot of people would be very surprised to find that, yeah, absolutely. A lot of people wonder how you would do that, but I think it can be done. I'd be well served if you had a chance to read a fairly obscure C.S. Lewis essay, but I wonder if, has anybody read the Parthenon and the Optative? Has anybody read that essay by Lewis? It's a really obscure, but it's a really good essay, and if you have a chance to check it out, you should. He points out that classics teachers had spent too much time gassing about the beauties of the Parthenon and too little time teaching the optative mood, right, of Greek grammar. He encourages teachers to ensure that students are actually doing the hard work of learning material before they're set loose to enjoy it or dislike it. But I think we all know the kind of questions that turn students loose in a pasture land of superlatives, and the kind of questions that turn down, like thumbscrews, on the student who hasn't really learned this text. In the first camp are questions like, explain how Charles Dickens' worldview informs the following passage from Bleak House, right? In the second, the student is given a passage from Bleak House and asked to explain where, within the plot, the sentence comes, who's speaking, and for what future event the author is preparing us, right? In the first sort of question, a student learns the sort of padding that the teacher wants and can answer easily. But that same student cannot answer the second question without actually knowing the book. So I would recommend in teaching music appreciation, if you want to do that sort of thing, that we expect students to demonstrate familiarity with the work. And I would encourage doing this by playing brief excerpts, ones that do not come from the very beginning of pieces, and asking students to identify the placement of those excerpts within a chart of the form of the piece, or at least to identify them by movement, right? So if I have a four-movement symphony, you play a short excerpt from the middle of the second movement, and they need to know that that excerpt comes from the second and not the first or the third or the fourth, right? But you can do better than that. You can actually push them to learn the piece well enough to actually tell you where within the form they are. And I could, of course, quiz you now and do the same thing. We're not going to do that. But you can see how this sort of process might work. And if you can't, let's talk about it here in just a second. I'm going to finish up and we ask some questions. And if you could do that, and if they could do that, you would be able to demonstrate that they know the music. You would know that they know the music because they know where they are within the piece. Now, many of you hear me say this, wonder if this doesn't sort of downgrade music, musical education in general, right? You may wonder, rightly, that merely learning to circle letters and remember passages is somehow fairly inconsequential when compared to the sublime joys of listening to serious music. And those who worry so are correct. It is, of course, no ultimate merit if our students merely learn music any more than it's a merit that they merely learn literature or history. Merit, in the way I'm using the word, is delighting in God as He makes Himself known, right? Having the affections turned toward the right things, right? And God makes Himself known generally through these works of man. So that's great, but we can't evaluate delight. Right? We cannot, to paraphrase Queen Elizabeth, create windows into men's souls. We can only discover whether they have any knowledge of the material we've assigned them. If we do not hold them accountable to learn this material and hold them rigorously accountable, we will have never given them anything about which to have legitimate affections. If, however, we force them actually to learn the material, we will have given them every reason, and the only reason, to delight in it. All right, we'll stop there. Questions, thoughts about this? Yes. It's significant. So there's some ways around this. The good old-fashioned way is to design a CD anthology and have it made or something like that, you know, or buy a text with anthologies. That's very expensive, and CDs are pretty obsolete, right? A lot of these students subscribe to things that allow them to download whatever music they please, basically, Spotify and whatnot. That's one way forward. My institution subscribes to Naxos Music Library, and their subscription rates are, there's a range, so you can buy as much or as little of that as you want. Other opportunities are to just have them all download and just make sure. But I think you raise a very important question. Obviously, we have an obligation to keep the magistrate's laws and to protect private property. Right? These are copyrighted works, and what I did here is legal because I own this recording. But there are certainly many, many illicit uses of music in the classroom. So the best way to do it is just make sure they all agree to download this. What I meant to say earlier was, I imagine your abilities are, in terms of time, are pretty minimal. So you're not going to be able to learn a lot of pieces, right? So the cost on this is pretty small, right? I mean, a download on iTunes is $1.29, you know? So it means you do that five times and you've got music curriculum for a semester, you know, or whatever. So it's, I would recommend those kinds of things. I wish I could say, what I really want to say is, well, you need to emphasize high fidelity playback too, because obviously listening to music in these horrible contexts is really debilitating for young students who are just coming to like it. But frankly, we can't expect them to go out and buy a set of $2,000 speakers, and you know, I mean, it's just not going to happen. Yeah. Yeah. Well, a case in point, I teach a lecture about two-thirds of the way through my gen ed course on a Brahms, last movement of Brahms, Final Concerto. And I just say, okay, I'm not going to put anything on the board. We're going to do a show of hands. Is this the same thing we just heard, or is this a new thing, right? Same, different. Same, different. Okay. Now, if it's different, let's talk about what's going on here. Are these related phrases? Are they unrelated, right? And you have to just work through the piece really slowly, right? And then walk it out. And of course it'd be wonderful to say, well, it's not Allegro form. You can get into all sorts of technical things. But most of us really just want to pique their interests. And having them listen that actively, they're going to be interested because they're going to want to put their hand up at the right time. They're going to want, you know what I mean? And I think that works remarkably well, even to the uninitiated. I don't know. Well, right, and I would love that, you know, I would love to get that far, but, I mean, most likely, you know, you want to find pieces that are eminently accessible. I mean, it's just, yeah. Oh, yeah, so the really young ones, key there is literature. So you got to find a piece that is really... clear chunks, right? That at the end of every little bit stops, right? And they can hear those stops really well. They understand that. And I think there it's repertoire more than anything else. You can use the same system of same difference to big boys and girls and little boys and girls. It works great. But if it's a really hard piece, like the Brahms piece I teach, half my class doesn't know. I mean, at college, I've been teaching them for a semester. Half of them aren't sure whether this is a new melody or the same thing they heard, which probably says more about me than anything else. But I think you need to pick repertoire wisely. Baroque music works really well, not Bach, but, you know, Vivaldi, Scarlatti, you could do worse than, I mean, some Handel pieces, like some of those little, you know, overtures, water music, stuff like that, that works fine. But you got to pick pieces that are chunky outable, you know. I find 19th century, I think 19th century stuff works great for the sort of angsty middle school, high school age. They just really get into that misery. So you can change your repertoire based on the group. But I think the same process would probably work, but just pick short, truly short pieces. I mean, the piece we just listened to, way too long for that age group, I think. They'd just be bonkers by the end of it, you know. I'm trying to think of any others off the cuff, but we can talk about it later. You know, I'll just, yeah.
Oh, kind of, that's nice. Yeah. Yeah, right. Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. 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 It could be a lot worse. Yeah, sure. Yeah. Yeah. No, no, no. That's a big part of it. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. 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 I mean, this is not a place for me to be cruel to mass commercial music. I'd love to do that in other contexts, but one of the things that I think those of us who listen to serious music find hard about it is we're constantly saying, "Why are you doing that? Why are you doing that?" But that doesn't have anything to do with what we were just doing. And there's all this going on that doesn't seem to have to do with anything, right? Whereas in serious music, all of those questions are happily answered all the time, all the way through. One thing just comes out, an extra book from the next. It's just this kind of straightforward thing. And that makes me understand God better, because that's how he works. He makes a world that is like that. Of course I see what he is doing. I mean, yes, absolutely. He's a God of kind providence, right? So there's, I think that's it. And I'm glad to have people who are non-experts teaching music appreciation. My experience is that having a PhD in musicology does by no means ensure that you like music. It's actually strangely not always a one-to-one correspondence there. And I have an economics colleague who I'm pretty sure knows more about music and listens more actively than many music scholars. You know? So I think it's I think that's great. I'd urge you all to do the same. As specialists are not necessarily welcome at this table. Yeah, go ahead. Yes, yes, yes. Yeah. Right, and that's obviously programmatic music. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Amazing. Yeah. Yeah. So, for starters, programmatic music is a little bit different because the composer's invited us. So he's given us a text to think about. So those of you who are not familiar with the terms like Vivaldi's Spring, there's a little bit of text that tells you, you know, okay, we're thinking about these things as we're hearing that. If you don't use that, you're not being fair to the composer's intentions. I mean, obviously he wants to build that in. So for starters, that's great. I think it's important at some stage in musical development, maybe not the earliest stages, so the question about the youngest, you can use those programmatic elements more with the little ones. I think because abstract meaning is pretty hard for little ones, right? But as we get older, we want to see that Vivaldi's Spring is not literally sound effects about spring, right? If it were that, it'd be a really bad set of sound effects and also a bad piece of music. As it turns out, it's a piece that would teach itself quite handsomely if we didn't know it was called spring, right? And there's a certain turn at some point among people that needs to happen there. But that's a developmental issue as much as anything else. So I think I would not take it too far to answer your initial question. I mean, I think obviously programmatic music has its place. And I think even analogies are very helpful to kids of all ages at a certain level. As long as you're constantly saying, this is a loose analogy. You know, this isn't what it means any more than the Pythagorean theorem. I mean, what does it mean, right? It's we can talk about that, but that's a tricky thing. Great. Other questions? Yeah. Yeah, sure. Okay. Right. Right. Yeah. 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 Well, I think that one of my colleagues after Munson is going to talk about affections and music a little bit later today, and maybe want to connect with him a little bit about that. Because that's,
there is a reason for feelings in people who are not pathological, right? People have emotions for reasons when their emotions are healthy, and music offers those reasons. There are things happening in pieces which solicit those emotions, right? These aren't about emotion, but they solicit those emotions because they're about musical meanings which are very abstract but very important.
We got time for a couple more here. Yeah.
Oh my, I play recordings. I mean, I'm a very bad pianist. I use the piano some, and I sing a lot. I mean, I sing a lot. I'm a singer by training, but not by practice. But I use recordings largely because they're predictable, repeatable. Students can get timbral associations with the recordings, and that helps them some degree. I use recordings in class because they're the very best, right? Anything I'm going to play is not going to be as good as Richter. So it's no matter what. So they're getting, and I try to focus on, I mean, my college is very generous in this regard, but I try to focus on high fidelity reproduction because the students are already coming in with a negative bias. So if you give them this crackly old recording, gross sounding speakers of classical music, they can't even hear the timbres right, they're going to be pretty confused by that, and they're going to rightly develop a distaste towards it based on that timbral bias right off the bat. That was a pretty old recording I played for you, by the way. Did you hear people coughing in the background? But I figure we're grown up, so we probably don't need that. You don't have a negative bias, but our students often do, So, yeah. So I use recordings a lot. Ooh, yeah, exactly. I deal with it every day in my class, right? Every day. So I've got loads of tips for you on that one. But I don't know how successful the tips are, but I do this all the time. So there are two ways, there are two basic rhetorical approaches to this. Everybody gets this problem, right, that students don't want to do it. They just don't want to deal with serious music. They like the music they like. They don't understand why we're having to do this. There are two approaches. First of all, there's the kind of soft approach, which is, look, I admit that this is very foreign to you. Of course it is. You have every reason not to like this. You've been trained not to like it, right? What I want to show you is that as a training that you may come to regret, right? That you may wish that it weren't so. Of course you wouldn't like it. The world has taught you from day one to treat music as a, this kind of sonic backdrop, or this like emotion machine. It's like soft drugs. I understand why you would then be reactionary against a music that doesn't give you any of that. The music I'm about to play you is not soft drugs. It doesn't work on you like that. Of course you're not going to like it. So be very patient with them. Say, look, this is, who isn't? It's back to George Grant's tallest words, humility, right? This is all of our circumstances, right? All of us face this problem. So that's one way. The other is the hard way, which is like, there's no legitimacy in your bias, right? Your bias is based on these things, and it's you're fleeing from God, right? So God makes himself known in meaningful things, and you have an eagerness towards unmeaningful things. You would like to have sensation rather than meaning. And that's why you don't like this music, because this music doesn't give you sensation. It gives you meaning. And meaning confronts you with the Almighty God, against whom you are opposed, because you're sin nature, right? So of course you don't like this music, but you better repent of that. So there's a soft and a hard, There's a soft and a hard side to that argument. And I just play one card or the other based on the student, right? Based on who I'm dealing with, based on how I can best judge their personalities. There are many other tricks on that front, but I'll maybe see if there's any other questions before we wrap up here. Anybody else? Yeah.
How would you format the testing for students at various
stages? Sure. You will claim me.
Yeah.
And ask you where we were in it. No, I wouldn't. But for kindergartners, I'm really not sure quite how I would evaluate it. For very, very young, I'm not sure to what degree evaluation would work. But if I were dealing with middle schoolers, what I would do is put up a little chart on the page and say, okay, I'm going to play for you a piece, an excerpt. You tell me where we start and where we end, or something like that, all right? And this is going to be a piece you've been working with them on, making sure they're very prepared, and then go from there. You know, so a little chart, and then start and end, right? Where does the excerpt start? Where does it end? Or just where does it end, right? Where does this excerpt end? Here's your chart. It's a chart they've known for a while. They're used to finding their place within it, right? And you can make that chart look however you want. I mean, it's, you know, on the page. Yep, yep, yeah, I think so. It's easy, it works well. Yeah, 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 very far away. Mm-hmm. Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm, yeah, there's a whole system of music education built on that, yeah. And that's a great idea, I think, especially at the younger ages, they're going to have these really hard and fast connections between gestures and between pictures and between melodic phrases, right? What? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, let's close out here. Yeah, right. I would love to be doing that in my undergraduate class more. It would be great to just assume that they could show up with that kind of ability. That would be great. Yeah. Yeah, great. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah, for scores is great. Yeah. Sure, I use it all the time. Yeah. They do also have recordings. Yeah. They're often... It's public domain. So that's right. Yeah, sure. SLP, International Music Score Library Project. So if you're that, all right, yeah. How are you doing? Mm-hmm. Hey, thanks very much, guys. Thanks so much. Yeah, appreciate it. Hey, thanks for that. I'm glad you mentioned the Facebook page. That's really good. Yeah, that's really helpful. Yeah. Oh, no. Well, yeah, it's exciting.
I'm not back today, but I may be back today. I've got a talk tomorrow afternoon.
Okay.
And
okay.
Actually, I'm in this room, I think, on the schedule.
Great.
But Paul Munson, I didn't know he was teaching.
Yeah.
But is that this afternoon?
It is this afternoon. I think it's next to the last session. So, yeah, great.
Good. Good to meet you.
Yeah. Yeah. Encouragement. All right, yeah, we're going to do that.